This is the first day of this July 2012 seven-day session, and we'll be reading for the first few days of this session from the teachings of Chinese Zen master Da Hui. And this is from a text called Swampland Flowers, The Letters and Lectures of Zen Master Da Hui, translated by Christopher Cleary. So we'll start by reading some biographical material, first from the text itself. These are Christopher Cleary's this is his writing, but then I'm going to switch over to another book. But so first of all, he was born, Da Hui was born in 1088, so a little more than 900 years ago, just south of the Yangtze River. At school, he, right from the beginning, he showed a preference for Buddhism over study, over worldly studies. Even at an early age, he was considered remarkable throughout the vicinity. At the age of 16, he left home for to join the monastery, and at 17, he dropped his hair. This must be a literal translation of the idiom from the Chinese of having his head shaved as a monk. It says he took delight in the doings of the Chan school. Chan, of course, is the original name for what we now call Zen, what became Zen in Japan. So when you hear Chan, just think Zen. And he read through the records of all of the five houses. These are the five main lineages at the time in this 11th century. He especially liked the words of Yunmen and Yunmen's teacher, Mu Chao. But he had doubts about these five lineages. Since originally there had been but one Bodhidharma, why were there so many schools? This is a question, I think, that that comes up for young people more than older people, teenagers. Somehow I'm rattling around in the recesses of my memory. I have some recollection of my schoolmates, or maybe it was me, I don't know. Having the question, why are there so many religions? If there's one truth, then why are there so many different religions that all say that their way is the way? Well, the short answer is because there are different types of people and different temperaments, and different religions appeal to different temperaments. Actually, for most of human history, you don't have really a menu of religions presented to you. You just go with the family religion. Here in the West now, we do have the ability to choose among different faiths, and we can certainly say that whatever tradition we stick with is one that we have an affinity with, some kind of a stronger affinity than with others. But to get back to the text, we're told that by nature he was exceptionally talented and not bound by convention. Now I'm going to switch to our other text, which is the one I usually use for biographical material for the Masters. This is Andy Ferguson's book, Zen's Chinese Heritage, The Masters and Their Teachings. It's this tremendous compendium of biographical material on the Chinese masters for hundreds of years. It says, as a young man, he happened to encounter a copy of The Record of Yunmen. Remember, we said that he especially liked the words of Yunmen. He felt strangely familiar with the text, as though he had previously studied it. Well, he probably had. Later, he traveled and practiced under various Zen masters, becoming familiar with the prevailing Zen currents of the era. This was common in ancient China, that when you weren't actually in a monastery, you were in the monastery for periods of 3 months, and then it would alternate with periods when you had the freedom to roam about, sometimes very far, hundreds of miles, where you would visit other teachers and try out their teachings. In Japan, this didn't carry through to Japan. In Japan, it's mostly, for hundreds of years now, in Japan, you commit to one teacher and you stay with that teacher sometimes for decades. It's a little early in American history of Zen to see what will become the most common, but so far I think most people in the United States, most Zen practitioners, find one teacher and stay for a long time with that teacher. Of course, you can be sure that either way, both ways have their pluses and minuses. First, he began training under a Zen master by the name of Zhan Tang Jun. This master, Zhan, recognized Da Wei's unusual ability and assigned him to work as his personal attendant. This would be very rare that a newcomer would have the honor of being in the position of personal attendant to the teacher. So, yes, Zhan must have seen in him exceptional potential. But, it says, Da Wei's obstinate personality clashed with his teacher, leading to an exchange in which Zhan ridiculed the young student, saying, "You haven't experienced enlightenment, and the problem is your intellectual understanding." This, of course, has been the obstruction for many people in Zen practice, where they can't detach from their beloved ideas and concepts. And really, you have to. If you're going to get anywhere in the real experience of the essence of Zen, you can't dwell in your ideas about it, tempting though that may be. And because the teachings of Zen are so intellectually sophisticated, many a bright person has been snared in the principles, the doctrine. In Theravadan Buddhism, which is a different tradition, in Theravadan Buddhism they have this idea of the near enemy of something, of a virtue, and I think of that when I think of the people who have a great appreciation for the teachings of Zen, but they don't. It's not enough to get them to the mat. Well, then the time they spend savoring the teachings of Zen in books, you could say, is the near enemy of actual practice. Or, to put it more simply, to use a Zen saying, a menu doesn't satisfy hunger. So we see what we read here so far is that here's a man of exceptional brilliance, a young man of exceptional brilliance, however, an obstinate personality. It doesn't quite say intellectual arrogance. The two often go together, a highly acute intellect and arrogance. But in any case, we see someone who has his share of obstruction in Zen practice. Later, Zhan, the master, became very ill. He called Da Wei to his side before he died, and he urged him to go train with Yuan Wu and apply himself diligently as his student. Yuan Wu is credited as the author of the Blue Cliff Record, a collection of koans, and was a highly esteemed master at the time. By the way, some of this material is a direct translation of the old records. The Chinese were unsurpassed in their record keeping, including in biographies. That's why we can trust these biographies, except in some details. We'll mention a couple of examples where you have to wonder about how factual they were, but otherwise, this is 900 years ago that Da Wei lived, and the Chinese, with their great veneration of Confucianism, the Confucian tradition has ancestor worship right at the center of the teaching. And so the Chinese have always been great biographers. The genealogical records go back, way back. I once read an article that the Mormon Church were dying to get their hands on the Chinese genealogical records. Some of you may not know, it's part of the, at least it always was, maybe it still is, has been part of their belief that they could save souls by marrying people by proxy. They could, if you marry someone, let's say they found the name Da Wei in the Chinese genealogical records, if they could have him married to a Mormon, then because now he's a member of the Mormon Church, that his soul would be saved. I know. We don't hear about that much from Mitt. Although we did hear something during the primary season where Jewish people, some of them were in an uproar about Mormons marrying Jews by proxy. It's a great treasure of biographical material that we have here that isn't available in most other cultures, certainly not our own. So, the dying Master Zhan sends Da Wei to the great Yuan Wu, and we're reading here the direct translation. Soon Da Wei traveled to Yuan Wu's residence, where he heard the master address the monks. In his talk, Yuan Wu spoke of an incident in which a monk asked Yunmen, what is the place where all Buddhas come forth? And Yunmen had answered, the water on East Mountain flows uphill. Then someone in the audience, see, first Yuanru relates this old exchange between a monk and Yunmen. And then we're back to present time there with Yuanwu. Someone in the audience asks Yuanwu, what is the place where all Buddhas come forth? And Yuanwu said, warm breezes come from the south, but in the palace there's a cool draft. And upon hearing these words, Da Wei's past and future were cut off. This question, what is the place where all Buddhas come forth? This member of the audience who asked this of Yuan Wu was probably not a beginner. What is the origin? What is the origin of this true nature itself? There's an old theological question that Christians have tangled with. If all things come from God, where does God come from? Well, this is not so different. What is the place where all Buddhas come forth? But then Yuan Wu's response, warm breezes come from the south, but in the palace there's a cool draft. What's the palace? And upon hearing these words, Da Wei's past and future were cut off. Although there was movement, forms were unmanifested. He felt himself sitting in a still, barren place. So in the other text we just were reading from, by Cleary, it said that he thought he was enlightened at this incident. Yuan Wu investigated, that is, he questioned him and found that though Da Wei had managed to get before and after cut off, so the aspect of motion does not arise, he was still settling down in purity and nakedness. In other words, he was still stuck in emptiness, as many before him had gotten stuck, and many since Da Wei have been stuck. Getting in a state, in other words, in your sitting, where you suddenly find yourself in this spacious realm of silence and stillness, and then lingering there, thinking that that is somehow the end point. But the masters have always gone to great efforts to shake the student out of that realm of emptiness, because emptiness is just half the truth. It's not the whole truth. That kind of emptiness, that one-sided emptiness, is a conditioned emptiness, which means that it is based on temporary conditions, and because it is not true awakening, it's subject to change. When the conditions change, this wonderful, wonderful, rapturous state of emptiness disappears, and one is back in one's thoughts. So Yuan Wu says to him, it wasn't easy for you to get to this stage. too bad that having died, you are unable to come back to life. The other differences in translations are fascinating. The Andy Ferguson translation is, "It hasn't been easy, but you've made your way to this great field. What a pity if you were now to die and not be able to attain life. It's a great error to rely on words. Without knowing where you'll fall, just let go of the edge of the cliff. Let yourself do it. After you wake up, you won't be deceived again. You must believe in this." In the other text, which is omitted in the one we just read, Yuan Wu, when Dawei first came to Yuan Wu, Yuan Wu quoted Yunmen as saying, "East mountain walks on the water." This is a simple koan, and assigned Dawei that koan. It says Dawei offered some 49 replies, but Yuan Wu didn't approve of any of them. And that's what preceded this experience of this profound experience of emptiness. 49, by the way, if you ever encounter that word in texts, it just means a hell of a lot of replies. Seven is a kind of a magic number in Buddhism, and 49 is 7 times 7, so... Once when Yuan Wu asked Dawei... Oh, excuse me, I skipped a paragraph. Thereafter, Dawei was selected to be an attendant in the Wood Hall, whatever that is. In this position, each day he accompanied the patrons of the temple when they waited to see and then entered the abbot's quarters for interviews. The other one, it says that Yuan Wu directed Dawei to spend time receiving and conversing with gentlemen of affairs who came calling. So somehow he must have figured that that this intercourse with visitors, this exchange, and this talking with visitors would force Dawei to develop himself in the realm of social interactions, and force him to learn to develop his sense of discrimination and sensitivity in social affairs. And then to these visitors, Yuan Wu would quote an earlier master and say, "It's like words without words, like a vine held up by a tree." So he often quoted that, Yuan Wu did. Once when Yuan Wu asked Dawei a question, Dawei started to answer when Yuan Wu cut him off by saying, "No, no." After 6 months had passed, Dawei asked Yuan Wu, "I've heard that previously you questioned Wu Zu about this phrase, but I don't know what he answered," which is a roundabout way of saying, come on, give me the answer. You know, what did Wu Zhu say? At least give me that. Yuan Wu saw through that little device, and he laughed and didn't reply to Da Wei's question. So Da Wei now is still stuck with this question. It's like words without words, like a vine wound around a tree. And then Da Wei pressed him. Yuan Wu wouldn't answer him, but Da Wei said, at that time you posed this question to everyone. Why not say it again now? So then Yuan Wu said, I said to Wu Zhu, what is the meaning of the phrase, it is words without words, a vine wound round a tree? Wu Zhu answered me by saying, you can't trace it, it can't be drawn. I then asked him, when the tree has fallen down and the creeper has withered, what then? The vine has withered, what then? Wu Zhu said, see what comes next. So all of this is Yuan Wu relating, this can get complicated, forgive me, Yuan Wu relating to Da Wei, our hero, this exchange that Yuan Wu himself had with Wu Zhu. And Wu Zhu's final answer at the time to Yuan Wu had been, see what comes next. And these words, Da Wei himself was enlightened. He said, I understand. Yuan Wu then asked him some probing questions, and Da Wei replied to each without hesitation. And finally, Yuan Wu approved him, saying, at last you know that I haven't been deceiving you. This is the realization that can hit one with great force after awakening, that all that time that one's teacher had been speaking the truth, not just delivering some doctrine, but just actually saying things as they are. So just to decode this a little bit, it is words without words, a vine wound around a tree. Of course, he's pointing to our true nature. He says you can't trace it, it can't be drawn. But then this question, well, what about when the tree has fallen down and the vine has withered? What about no true nature, no true self versus small self, big self, small self, true nature? What about when all that's gone? And that's when Wu Zhu had said, see what comes next, which precipitated Da Wei's awakening. And it was a deep awakening. So before long, Yuan Wu shared his teaching position in the monastery with Da Wei. Da Wei's reputation as a talented teacher spread widely, and in the year 1126, when he was only 37 years old, the prime minister himself presented him with the ceremonial purple robe and the honorific title Great Teacher Buddha Sun. Sun is spelled S-U-N. That extremely high honor for someone who's only 37. And then we are told of all of these background political struggles. It was a time of great discord in China. One of Da Wei's students became enmeshed in this political struggle. He was a government official, and his opponent, this government official's opponent, got the upper hand and executed Dawi student, and that by implication Dawi fell out of favor with the court and he had to flee with his monks to another province. While he was there, he used his time to compile the records of many ancient teachers along with a large number of koans. And then some 13 years later, he and his monks were forced to move again because of social unrest. He went farther this time, and in this southern city in Guangdong province, half of the more than 100 monks under Dawi died from plague and famine. It's hard for us to imagine this. We're so privileged to have the leisure, and it is leisure, to be able to come to Sishin. We're so privileged to be able to practice this Dharma, and almost all of us have comfortable enough middle class lives to hear that half of Dawi's monks died of plague and famine. There is this idea out there that Dawi was critical of Soto Zen, the chief proponent of Soto Zen teaching at the time was a master Hongzhi. But today many scholars point out that there was mutual respect and cordial relations between Dawi and his supposed adversary. And so much so that Hongzhi, when he was dying, requested that Dawi take care of his final affairs after he died. And I'm going to forego reading the various dialogues here that are presented in Andy Ferguson's book, and just go to the end of Dawi's life. This was in the year 1163. Says, in the year 1163, a falling star fell to the west of the temple with a terrifying flash. Dawi soon became slightly ill. Eventually, his monks inquired about his health. He exerted himself and said in a loud voice, "Tomorrow I'm setting off on a journey." And the next day, sure enough, he personally wrote his testimonial. He wrote a farewell letter to a certain layman friend. And then at the request of his monks, he composed a final verse. He picked up his brush and with large... this was a tradition that a master was supposed to write some final words of wisdom before he died. And these were Dawi's final words. "Birth is thus, death is thus. Verse or no verse, what's the fuss?" Then he threw down the brush and died in a composed manner. He was 55 years old. And that's it for biographical material on Dawi. And now we'll go to the text. Just start it, with a few minutes left. Go to the text of Swampland Flowers, the letters and lectures of Zen Master Da Wei. I'm going to pick up in the middle of the text. A couple years ago, I read from the first half of the book, and I'm going to pick up from there. So, what we'll be reading now will be at least 4 or 5 years since we've read it. And this is a letter to a Shu Tongji. I'll refrain from reading the names of the recipients of the letter because it's be meaningless to anyone here. But these are letters to actual people, his students. And he begins the letter, "This affair is like the bright sun in the blue sky, shining clearly, changeless and motionless, without diminishing or increasing. It shines everywhere in the daily activities of everyone, appearing in everything. Though you try to grasp it, you cannot get it. Though you try to abandon it, it always remains. It is vast and unobstructed, utterly empty. Like a gourd floating on water, it cannot be reined in or held down. Since ancient times, when good people of the path have attained this, they've appeared and disappeared in the sea of birth and death, able to use it fully. There is no deficit or surplus. Like cutting up sandalwood, each piece is it. Or we could say, every single thing is this Buddha nature. From the tiniest grain of sand to the highest mountain. Each one of us is it. We're not just a part of it. Each little piece of sandalwood, when it's cut up, it is it. It's sandalwood. Each one of us is the whole, not just a fragment of it. This analogy of the sky, the sun and the sky, is a wonderful one. It's been used throughout Zen history. It conveys the absolute presence of this essential nature of ours, something that's beyond coming and going. He's saying we couldn't get away from it if we tried. Even our trying, if we were to try to get away from our true nature, the trying itself would be the functioning of our true nature. And how can we grasp what is our own self? Though you try to grasp it, you cannot get it. How can we get what we are? It is vast and unobstructed, utterly empty. To say that it's empty doesn't mean it's without form. We can say that the sky is empty, but then there are clouds sometimes. The clouds, too, are empty. Since ancient times, when people of the way have attained this, they've appeared and disappeared in the sea of birth and death, able to use it fully. Here I would suggest that he's not talking about literally physically dying and being reborn, but this appearing and disappearing in the sea of birth and death, this means in the coming and going of our daily lives, able to use it fully. Nothing lacking, nothing in excess. Shining clearly, changeless and motionless. Each particular practice that any one of us is working on in Zen is leading us to that realm of mind. The breath is that realm. Mu is another word for that realm. Every koan is a device for directing us to that realm of our true nature. It's a realm of direct experience. It's pointing us away from thoughts to the thing itself. The living, vibrant reality that is our nature. Another letter, this is to someone else, he says, there has never been anything to give to people, only folks who have been able to point out the road for people. Now, this is just classic teaching of Zen. It's what we realize for ourselves with awakening. There's nothing a teacher can give to someone that she or he doesn't already have. It's not a matter of acquiring anything. It's just a matter of opening our eyes. And then he quotes someone he refers to as just an ancient worthy. So another, a master of an earlier age. He says, having some attainment is the jackal's yelp. Having no attainment is the lion's roar. This is a wonderful reminder, something especially important to more experienced practitioners, especially someone who's had some degree of awakening, to think of oneself, that's the key element here, to think of oneself as having attained something. Well, this is like the yelping of a jackal. But having no notion in the mind of having attained anything, this is the lion's roar. Again and again, the masters urged us to let go of any notion of ourselves as having gotten anything, attained anything, realized anything. This is not easy. When we have had some kind of an insight, one kind or another, it is so natural to want to savor it, to think about it, to even with pride of what one has realized and how one is different from other people. One is not different from other people. We are all equally endowed with this essential nature. There's nothing we acquire through awakening. Nothing. He goes on in this letter, Buddha was someone who had mastered adaptation. In the course of 49 years, there's that 49 again, in the course of 49 years, in more than 360 assemblies where he taught the Dharma, that's another favorite number, 360. In the Three Pillars of Zen, Yasutani Roshi refers to let mu permeate your 360 bones and 84,000 pores. in more than 360 assemblies where he taught the Dharma, he guided people according to their individual faculties. Thus he taught with one voice through all realms, while sentient beings each obtained benefits according to their kind. It's like, and this is a quote, one gust of the east wind and the myriad grasses all bend down. End of quote. The Dharma preached by the Buddha is also like this. One fundamental teaching that may come out in many different ways, but for each person, it has the same effect. One has the mind, the ears to hear it. One gust of wind and the many grasses all bend down. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.